Okay, Joe, we're back for our 62nd number 62 episode of Powers and Principalities. Tonight you wanted to discuss, kind of symbols and.
Yeah, symbols. I mean, they're everywhere. They're symbolic. Why are they there? You know, symbols have had quite a history with humanity, haven't they? I mean, we're sort of the symbolic animal. It's one way of characterizing it. But in terms of our current moment, I think a lot of the symbols that are in our culture are have ancient tradition. And I think a lot of people don't know this, and so it might be valuable to actually expose some sort of the hidden symbolism in our culture. A lot of people are already, you know, doing this. This is fairly common stuff now on the internet. I would recommend Jay Dyer. I think he does a really good job of exposing sort of hidden symbolism. I have a few of the things that I find just kind of very interesting and very revealing. And I wanted to talk, Tim, about how if you know that someone has a symbol or has something symbolic in, you know, in their lyrics, or, you know, there's a symbol that is sort of hidden, but you can actually make it coherent with some study, what you get is a better understanding typically of the thing that the symbolism is within. And I'm just going to start out with talking about Keith Richards, the decadent Rolling Stone lead guitarist. You know, on his surface, he seems to be a perfectly, pleasant individual. He's kind of known for being a drug addict. And in that way, he's just a full-on culture debaser, but he's always got a smile on his face, and he's generally liked. I was at a concert, a rock and roll concert here in Santa Barbara. This happens a lot, and I was invited and went, and I saw this old guy had a T-shirt, and it had a picture of Keith Richards passed out in a chair, and underneath it was the line, "Keith Richards for President." And so I thought, well, I would like to take his ability to vote away from this individual. But
still hasn't grown out of the 60s, huh?
No, he hasn't. And you know,
he's caught in that loop.
He's caught in the loop. And LSD, you know, if you take too much of it, can kind of fry your capacity for some what they would call eloquent thinking. And that poor individual was suffering from that condition, in my opinion. But anyway, so I saw a documentary about Keith Richards. And in it, he's well known for having a skull and bone ring. Mm-hmm. The skull and bones is a representation of Freemasonry. Now, from time to time, it appears for other reasons, but in general, it's a Freemason symbol, and certainly Richards is using it as such because you see, once you have this little cipher of understanding the symbol, for one thing is in the documentary, they have some film of Richards' home in England in the countryside, and he has the front of his home constructed into a pyramid. the roof. And at the top of it, where the all-seeing eye would be, you have the lavish tongue emblem of the Rolling Stones.
Of course, yes.
And but it's this very important symbolism, because you can see that, you know, remember we talked about good old authoritarian personality, you know, chapter 23, where they talk about how they're going to use arrows as propaganda against the Gentiles. Well, here you get to see this, you know, from someone who was in the very beginning of this, you know, the kind of current cultural trajectory, Keith Richards and the Rolling Stones. I mean, suddenly, see, if you understand that this is, you know, that he's representing Freemasonry, then you can understand his home. You can understand why he has the skull and bones. The skull and bones is everywhere throughout Richard's home. They actually go into it in the documentary. And his glasses, his drinking glasses, have the skull and bone on it. And the other thing is, he has a film company, and it has the empty skull, just like the Grateful Dead. You know, the skulls, and this is a symbol. It's basically reversing the Roman mockery with the use of the term Golgotha, which means empty skull. This would be where Jesus was crucified, and so this you know, people who read the Gospels as the Freemasons do, they see that as you know, a mockery of basically of you know, the Roman way of crucifying the Jewish Messiah. And so, as they you know, bring about the New World Order, they want to reverse this. So you get like the Grateful Dead with the skull, and you also get Keith Richards' film company, which has, you know, basically just the empty skull, numb skull, as its symbol. And I would also say that once you understand Richards as a culture debasing Mason, you get to understand even some of the lyrics, like "Jumpin' Jack Flash." Seems like it's just kind of a mindless rhythm blues thing. But actually, it's based on William Blake's poem. I believe it's called "The Timeless Traveler." I'm just forgetting. But Blake wrote a poem that has the idea of you know, that being raised by a hag and the storm that breaks, and the lyrics are actually stolen right from Blake. And Blake's poem, where "Jumpin' Flack." Jumpin' Jack Flash is, you know, emanating from, is just a depiction of the long process of bringing about the, you know, the New World Order. I mean, Blake is, you know, one of the, people wonder if he's a Mason. Well, for heaven's sakes, you know, look at his art with, you know, all of the compasses and the one eye. It's everywhere, you know. I also would point out that this, you know, when you understand Mason Richards in this light, even the band makes more sense, because one of the things about the Rolling Stones that's very important to know is that it was funded by the London School of Economics, which was completely under control at this time by the Rothschilds, who had actually set the thing up. And one of them was actually on the board of trustees when the Stones were funded. So when you go to Sympathy for the Devil, and they talk about, you know, a gentleman who's, you know, wealth and, you know, taste. And I mean,
yeah,
it doesn't really take a whole lot of, you know, of like decoding to really get, you know, understand that the Rolling Stones, which are supposedly leading you into this Eros, right, are actually leading you into the slave camp. Funded by the Rothschilds. So I would say the band needs a little more scrutiny than just the mindless adulation, you know, that people present to it when it makes these appearances. I'm going to send you a t-shirt, Tim, with Keith Richards for president and a big circle with a line through it over Keith's passed out face. I know we want to talk about other things. I just wanted to, because it's kind of in theme, I wanted to mention Stuart Brand. Now, Stuart Brand, he's the guy who did the Whole Earth Catalog, and he actually was helped, very technical guy, helped develop the mouse. He was, certainly involved in the process by which we now have the iPhone everyone stares into all day long. So Brand was very important culturally. He was on the bus with Ken Kesey, but long before that, the intrepid researcher Steve Outram found a video of Brand at what was called, and again, I'm forgetting, but I believe it was just called the Human Being. And this was on the University of San Francisco campus. Anyone who's interested in the video, and you all should be, because it's just fascinating. Outram will play it for you, or find, he'll send you the links to it. Maybe just on the web. Maybe if you just Google, Stuart Brand and Human Being in San Francisco. But here's the point. This was before Kesey's acid test, before even, you had the really degenerated hippie movement. Brand was there at this culture shifting event, and you have these creepy guys talking about how culture is changing, and we're here to get to know each other, and but you can see that it's all just mind control, leading. These guys are taking you into the New World Order. But the point is that they have a rock and roll band, and it's, and the name is like Satan's Slaves, I think. It's just ludicrous, and they're horrible. But they have a few kind of, just quasi beatnik types sort of staggering around. Nobody can dance at all. But in the midst of them is Stuart Brand. And he is the worst dancer you've ever seen. It's absurd. It's obviously he's just doing this because he's being filmed. I mean, you can see he just has no rhythm, and he's just kind of staggering. Looks like he's going to fall over. But my point is, Brand is wearing a white jumpsuit and a black top hat. You see, now, if you know the symbols of masonry, you can see what he's representing. Mm-hmm. Look at the photographs of the Rothschild parties, and you'll see that everyone, the Masons are all dressed in black and white with black top hats. The black top hat's just one of the Masonic, it means like master Mason, So Brand, with his top hat on, he's sort of, on one hand, he's looking far out and wild, he's dressed weird, culture's going in a new direction. But on the other hand, see, there's the symbolism, right? And so that's, just something that if you're aware of, then you will, it makes more sense. Also, in the video that Outram has, you have one of the creepiest things you'll ever see. You have Allen Ginsberg has been given control over a young boy that someone has lost.
Oh, terrific.
And Ginsberg comes out and talks about, we've lost this, someone's lost this little boy, I'm taking good care of him. And really, this is just the sickest thing you've ever seen. Because obviously, to give Ginsberg the child, someone, they would have known, the people who were running the thing, that Ginsberg was a pedophile. Mm-hmm. And incidentally, Outram also has, because there are some people who will contest this. They'll say, oh, no, Ginsberg wasn't a pedophile. Well, have Outram play you the video of Ginsberg at NAMBLA. He actually has a video of Ginsberg talking about, sex with children. So he's just the sickest thing imaginable. So this is like the duality, you have, this is Eros. It's just going to be fun. Everything is going to be take drugs. We'll have sex. There's music. But you see, the organizers have this sinister, just absolutely sinister perspective. And this really helps people realize that, hey, we're being taken off a cliff. This isn't, we're not, you know, we're, we're not being given drugs and told to fornicate and in the dirt because it's fun. It's because it's debasing, you know. And if you kind of know the symbols, then you're less likely to, you know, to succumb. So, Tim, what are some of your favorite symbols?
Well, I think the most conspicuous, I think, is well, Washington D.C., which is one giant Masonic temple in some respects. You know, Washington Monument. It's 666 feet tall, I think.
Yeah.
You have, of course.
Now, I just want to stop you. Why would they do that?
Well, because Washington was a well-known Mason, that's why. So
yeah, but why 666? I mean, 666 is in the apocalypse, right? Are they? And so obviously, they're promoting the apocalypse. I mean, wouldn't you say that's a natural understanding of them?
Yeah, it's obviously they're they're invoking the. The beast 666 and these things and the revelations and these, you know, they study them and interpret to how they interpret it or at least promote it. I think if you look at the Capitol building on top, you have Columbia, the goddess or something. Symbol there. Some people say it's ISIS. Some people say no, it's not ISIS. It just looks like ISIS. you have the painting in the Capitol of George Washington's, so George Washington's apotheosis, which is, you know, rather, I guess, Masonic in a way.
Well, yeah, I would say so. Yeah, somewhat. Yeah.
Of course, you cross the river in Alexander, you have the which I see almost every day, is the the Masonic Temple, which is the over there. So, I mean, there's that. So the symbolism is all there, the architecture and these things. And some people say it just harkens back to, the classical period that the founding fathers tended, were into. But there's symbolism everywhere because this is basically reflects the importance of Freemasonry in the founding of the country. And that's what some historians, it's just, Freemasonry, they form these lodges, there's a lodge in every city, and now that these are just mutual aid societies or benevolent associations, business associations, networking, these things. And there's a certain degree, they're correct. It does function that way because you have Porch Brethren and you get into the inner circle. You get less, people who know more, you get less profane until you're in the inner circle. Supposedly that's how it works. You have all that. People have written about, of course, the importance of Masonry in the founding of the United States, and of course that goes to the true nature of the American Republic, because Masonry itself, Freemasonry, kind of, as I understand it, grew out of workers' guilds or trade guilds in Europe in the 14th and 15th century. And as those kind of went by and by in that time, in the 16th, 17th century, what happened was that network, or at least that method of communicating and networking, was taken up, and you had what you called speculative masonry. And this is, at one time it was designed to maintain and keep trade secrets. Well, it was more or less adapted to maintain lines of communication to keep other secrets, occulted knowledge in these things. So masonry, in many respects, you can see as you may not be a particular ideology or religion per se, just it's a method that you use to attain your goals and network and these things to maintain secrets. And that's why largely it was picked up by the British Empire in the 18th century and used to expand and maintain the empire. Of course, that also includes the United States. Of course, with Masonry, you do have specific beliefs in it. One is sort of indifferentism, or sort of this, promote the idea that all religions are kind of the same. So basically, no religion is worth much, I guess. The objective in Freemasonry was to sort of a part of this Illuminist project was to destroy throne and altar and establish free republics, and these things. And this this is what occurred, of course, in the United States when you had the Revolutionary War to supposedly overthrow or kick out the British, and America was then independent. But of course, Masonry still played an important part because I think you and I have talked about how it's kind of behind the scenes, a lot of historic events like the Mexican War, Manifest Destiny, the American Civil War, so-called, and various presidents, many presidents have been Freemasons themselves. A few have been anti-Masons. I have spoken up against Masonry. Of course, there's the Anti-Masonic Party, too, that was a political party. I think they actually, in Vermont, in one presidential election, actually, the Anti-Masonic Party actually won that state, the presidential candidate. In Vermont, one time was taken very seriously. 8 or 9 papal encyclicals have been written condemning Masonry, and there was a time when the Catholic Church acknowledged the problems of Masonry, and of course, and its problems in relation to the United States and the idea of Americanism and these things, because Freemasonry basically is consistent with the American ideal of the of this idea of separation of church and state, which isn't in the Constitution, but nevertheless is the letter of the law. But The idea that you can have like a republic based on sort of a civic religion. So that's kind of the idea of Masonry in the United States. And most people still see that as benign. But we all know that Masonry has been used as a way of networking and organizing to do sort of, nefarious or illegal operations behind the scenes in these things, to engage in high-level criminality. And so it's a sort of an organizing principle, a working technology to achieve those ends. Interesting area where you see a lot of imagery is in the entertainment field. Hollywood and Hollywood and music. And you see it in music videos and these things, whether it's a Katy Perry video or Britney Spears video, or it seems like every halftime performance now, which has been highly in the recent years, been, or at least the past 20 years, become a huge part of the Super Bowl and most of this American entertainment, seems to be like it's sort of a satanic ritual. And so what happens is you have some people watching it, they've more or less succeed in letting hundreds of millions, if not a billion people, partake in a satanic ritual, and unwittingly in many cases. So that's kind of what you see out there. Again, I think the trick here is to have kind of everyone participate unwittingly, and perhaps there's some sense of once you do that, you're relieved of the karmic effect of some of the evil things you do, because you've more or less had it out there for all to see, hiding in plain sight, and when that happens, perhaps there's some sort of weird sense where they believe that the people have given their consent. I mean, you can make it so obvious, and yet no one does anything about it or resists it.
Right. And then the revelation of the method is what some people, call that. I have a different take. My feeling is that Masonry was kind of a secret part of Judaism going way, way back. Mm-hmm. I look at, if we'd get into this technical stuff, would really get like, put everyone to sleep. But just in general, Josephus, when he talks about what's going on in the Roman Jewish war, he writes about these tectons that are kind of with the leadership, and they're trying to burrow out, he is alluding to Simon and John kind of in a typologic way, in my opinion, to the characters in the gospel. And tecton is, even though they translate it in King James as carpenter, actually means mason. I mean, mm-hmm. it is the word that is designating Freemasons in Greek today, tecton. And so it's, and I also think that, again, that getting into symbolism, the fact that the character in the Gospels is 33, I think, when he dies, I think that's very, indicative of the number system of Freemasonry, where 33 is, has some kind of mm-hmm. magic connotation. You have a symbolism in a way that helps kind of explain some of the films. I mean, like, for example, in Dr. Strangelove, you know, they have a character named Mandrake. And, you know, you wonder, well, what the heck is, why is he named Mandrake? Well, Romeo and Juliet, actually, in the scene, the empty tomb scene, you know, has the description of the screaming Mandrake, right? Now, again, this goes back to Josephus. Josephus basically used the Mandrake as a way to mock the Jewish Messiah. He has this long passage about, you know, like a plant called the sun. You know, remember the son of David is a branch of David and the root of Jesse, right? So the Jewish Messiah has this vegetative symbolism. And so Josephus mocks this with this plant called the sun that would have grown on forever, but the Jews cut it down. You know, I mean, he's like, you know, kind of making some obvious allusions. Anyway, in the passage, he talks about that you have to basically.
Okay, we're back. Sorry. Okay, lost.
Sorry, connection. We had some technical problems, folks. This happens. Anyway, so I just wanted to conclude by saying that Josephus has, you know, this kind of obviously symbolic story about a root that's very sacred, and that it's called the sun, the baras, you know, like bar. It is related by in Josephus to the mandrake. And so basically it's a joke on the Jewish Messiah, which was a vegetative, you know, there's a lot of vegetative symbolism concerning the Jewish Messiah in the Old Testament. You have the branch of Jesse and the root, or the branch of David and the root of Jesse, you know. And so the Messiah is likened to this vegetative, you know, human. And so Josephus mocks this. And then it's taken up again by the Masons, and they reverse it. The Masons are, you know, I think are working on the New World Order, which is basically a post-Christianity. And so part of what they are engaged in with their, you know, their films and stuff is basically an eye for an eye, you know, with the impression of the Gospels that they have, you know. I mean, obviously people have other interpretations, but I just think this is how they see it.
This is where all the celebrities make that eye symbol.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, all that. They are all, this is all the all-seeing eye of Horus. You know, if you look at like the dollar bill, you have the all-seeing eye. Yeah. Keith Richards, obviously, you know, is, you know, makes a reference to it with his, the way he has his home constructed, the all-seeing eye. This is the idea that, and this is one of the, it goes into the Illuminati symbolism, which is to say that, in their opinion, the old world order is in the darkness, right? So that, but they can see because they have this illumination. Fire is often used as a symbol of the Mason's progress. And I'll give a really good example of that, real nice one to see. If you ever see the conclusion of Fantasia, what you have are hundreds of people in the distance carrying a fire. They're all carrying their own little fire, and they're walking someplace. You can't really see them, but they're all walking, you know, steadfastly along. And then all of a sudden, from over the horizon, you can see the most brilliant forms of light, you know, oranges and reds. It's like a nuclear bomb, which is kind of what it represents. But this is the idea of they have the illumination. The old world order is in the dark. This is sort of how they, I think, see themselves justified to genocide everybody. You know, you when you look at how light is represented, you should pay attention. I think an alert viewer of modern media will pay attention, because you'll sometimes be able to see representatives of you know, being able to see in the dark or creating light. And this is why the owl is one of their key symbols, because of the owl's capacity to see in the dark. The owl is on the dollar bill, you know, with along with the all-seeing eye. So this would be, you know, a way of understanding the symbols is that the New World Order team thinks that they can see in the darkness of the old world, and they had the light, they had the illumination. And, you know, okay, so they have, you know, this perspective, but you have to remember that the way they have constructed it and passed it along to the generations, I mean, they are really talking about basically having, you know, no one left on the earth but them. That's all that they're referring to when they talk about these things. I mean, they are going to genocide everyone. And maybe over a period of time, slowly, with vaccines and diet and whatnot, or maybe, you know, in camps. I mean, they use concentration camps all the time. But like a good example of this would be Dr. Strangelove again. The code that Mandrake was trying to solve, which was created by, I think his name is General or Colonel Jack Ripper.
Yeah, right? General Jack D. Ripper, yeah.
D. Ripper, remember, we spoke about the Masonic Ripper last week. You know, it's kind of funny. But anyway, he finds this sheet of paper that Ripper has been scribbling on, and he intersects two phrases, peace on earth and purity of essence.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he decides that POE has to be the code, and off they go, but they can't avoid the apocalypse. Somehow, the apocalypse is not put off. But I would point out that Terry Southern and Kubrick, who wrote the screenplay, are both, you know, believe me, as demonic. You know, I mean, they are just the full blown Satanists, you know. And so what the two things are the same: purity of essence and peace on earth. Now, I mean, what is this? Well, purity of essence is the remnants, right, that are left, you know, the purity of essence, meaning the reduction of mankind to, you know, it's just these elite individuals who are going to survive. And then, of course, this brings about peace on earth. And then the code is used to set off the bomb. And so, see, you can see that there's actually a kind of coherent, you know, narrative underneath the surface narrative, right? That they're actually, you know, the symbols are being arranged in such a way that someone who's really alert and knows about, you know, the symbolism can actually see a whole other movie. Because in this movie, you know, you can see that the apocalypse is not the tragedy, it's the triumph. And the remnant that survives are not, you know, like, you know, some kind of defeated group, but rather they're the victors. They are the ones that actually organized all this and brought it about. And I think it's the same thing at the conclusion of Fantasia. And, you know, so I don't want to, you know, just go on into too deep of these kinds of ideas. But if you watch, the Coen Brothers films, mm-hmm. you can see that they use these kinds of symbols just over and over again. I mean, they are... you know, completely satanic, Masonic, you know, I think the two are synonymous. And so when you apply kind of the understanding that I think we've done a pretty good job, Tim, not to toot our horn, but I do think we've been pretty, you know, accurate and relentless in fleshing out the schematic. If you listen to all the shows, then you'll be able to, I think, there's information that would be valuable for someone looking at films to keep from succumbing, you know, to the mind control and be alert and see that this is the symbolism of genocide, the symbolism of the Masonic project.
Yeah, of course, entertainment would be a main venue or method that they would use to... to have their alchemical, you know, process. activated, because that's how you get the people's attention and subtly change their attitudes, their values, their actions, you know, their beliefs. Earlier on, you mentioned, you know, understanding some of this occult symbolism in Hollywood is very important. And for that, you mentioned, yeah, Jay Dyer's work on that is very important. He writes about Hollywood. He goes, Hollywood is, as David Lynch titles it, an inland empire, a kind of a covenantal city state of its own, with its own religion, including all the trappings of neophytes, acolytes, servants, agents, star saints, hierophants, hierarchs, and holy sites. It is a veritable polis of initiatory esoterica, where the holy sites and the rites of Hollywood are not the altars of the mainstream religion, but another ancient religion, ultimately summed up in the epitaph of the ancient mysteries. The ancient mysteries comprised the competing religious practices of the empires of old. But the one empire that seems to have achieved the most appropriate association with Hollywood is Babylon, the gate of the gods. And it is sort of a revival of Babylonian, you know, of the Babylonian Empire. In fact, you know, Kenneth Anger's book, Hollywood Babylon, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I thought that he—that's, you know, Hollywood is. It's Hollywood's kind of like is the cathedral to this new religion, or rather old religion, depends how you look at it.
Yeah.
You mentioned, like, you know, movies like obviously talented movie makers or directors like the Coen brothers, like Stanley Kubrick. They make, you know, wonderfully. They make wonderful movies, but embedded in these movies is something that's really disturbing. And most of them are, you know, whether it's No Country for Old Men or Fargo, Dr. Strangelove, of course, other Stanley Kubrick's work, like, of course, what's Barry Lyndon?
Eyes Wide Shut.
Eyes Wide Shut, that's not that well hidden, I guess.
I mean, just kind of absurd. You know?
Yeah. So out there, I guess. What's the other one? Of course, Space Odyssey, of course.
2001
Space Odyssey.
Clockwork Orange is just, I don't know if you've seen it recently, but it's just complete 100% Masonic cesspool. So it's, someone like Kubrick, they say that, well, you know, he had the power to be able to create his own movies. This is nonsense. I mean, believe me, he had no power to create his own movies whatsoever. He had to stay within the Masonic framework, right? And so, you know, someone has to vet this stuff. You can't just, you know, turn people around. So I don't know who it is, how the authority in Hollywood works, but it is certainly there, obviously, you know, to make sure that that there is constant debasement and constant humiliation and degrading, because, you know, they're not just, you know, genociding, they're also humiliating. I mean, it's just it's a big part, you know, I hate to say it, but this is how they get their kicks, you know, they enjoy that. And so the symbolism is how they do it. You know, this is why it's kind of a tough slog. I don't recommend the faint of heart pick up Understanding Hollywood Symbolism, you know, because it is very, very brutal. But I'm just saying that for the researcher, this is just critical that people get in there and understand this stuff, because it's basically the way that they're giving us, you know, what clues we have as to how they're organized, you know, and it'll give us understanding of how to respond.
Yeah, and also this idea that there is organization and coordination going on here. I guess some people think that all these celebrities make these gestures just sort of a trolling or just to get attention, and maybe sometimes that is the case. Maybe often it is the case. Maybe most of the times it is the case. I don't know.
Yeah,
maybe,
sure.
But nevertheless, these symbols are there, and anything from, like, Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, to the Stone's Sympathy for the Devil, and you have today, you know, more contemporary music with the videos. You'll see all types of, you know, satanic and Masonic symbolism in these things. You know, why is that? And I mentioned earlier, of course, these rituals that are subjected to should we decide to watch the Super Bowl. Why is it always there, right? I mean, it's obvious.
It's not exactly putting people in the seats, is it? I mean, it's just, so it's there to humiliate.
To change, because remember, we were talking about serial killers last week? Was it last week? And I read that quote from Michael Hoffman about the importance of ritual. He cites the example of the Latin Mass, the Tridentine Mass, and how that the effect it had on European culture, keeping everyone Catholic, so to speak. Well, sure. That's an example of ritual. And so, what's the effect of a satanic halftime ritual? What's the alchemical effect on that on society when so many people are watching it? What's the alchemical effect of these music videos and movies having these symbols? It's not just the symbolism, it's usually the message in the movies, whether it's the sex, these things, or the violence in these things. So it's going to have its effect. And you look around you, if you don't think it's this type of the gestures and the message in the movies, the music hasn't changed society, you just look around you, go to a mall, look at people.
Yeah, well, go to your local Freemason lodge, for God's sakes. I mean, do you have one near you, Tim, where you live?
Yeah, in fact, yeah, there's one. My son's Little League team, one of the teams was sponsored by him.
Well,
and they always won. No, I'm just joking.
Yeah. It's funny. Like here in Santa Barbara, where I live, it's just this like little podunk town. And we've got a street named Mason Street. We've got an enormous temple. And this is the fact. If you go up to the door, you have the symbolism, right? You have the square and the G, you know. It's,
yeah.
It's kind of like it doesn't make a big deal about itself. It's just there it is, sort of in this fancy little street. But the door has glass that's like 4 inches thick. I mean, you couldn't shoot a howitzer through that thing. It's completely – and this is – you know, inside Santa Barbara, that's just really unique. And I saw this guy sent me a picture of the head lodge in Switzerland, right?
Mm-hmm.
And people had complained because it had, I mean, basically 20 square meters of electronic, equipment like arranged on the side of the building. And the frequency energy was so intense that kids couldn't sleep like 100 yards away from the thing.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And so the thing is like, well, you have to say yourself, well, why do they need this kind of communication? You know, what is this?
What's going on there? Yeah.
Yeah, is this because they got to get the next Shriners Day parade organized, you know? I mean, that seems to me that the public's a little asleep at the switch here, because, you know, the Masonic, and remember, as we have, you know, talked about, and I've made the point, that, you know, there is a relationship between Judaism and Freemasonry that is not understood, that is not disclosed, because you just have just too many times where hundreds of examples where there is this relationship that has no organic, seemingly organic relation, reason to exist. Like, as an example, look at the origins of Zionism and the British Freemasonry Quattro Coronati group.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, now why would these Anglicans wanting to, you know, to get Zionism started in the middle of the 1800s? Well, it needs an explanation. And I mean, so that when you then see Aldous Huxley, you know, who is famous for making the one eye symbol, right? I don't know if he's really the first one. I think as far as I know, he's the one that, to me, it's like he started promoting. You see all these pictures of Huxley.
Yeah.
One eye, you know, and so I think that that's kind of, he had a lot of influence in show business. So maybe that's where I, you know, the people are doing it. Before that, it was more the unseen hand. You know, the hidden hand was
Napoleon.
Very popular. You know, and with all of the cryptomations, they'd almost typically always have a picture or painting of themselves with this. And again, this is a symbol that if you understand it, you know, history makes sense. You can understand then that, well, this is why the armies are held together at Gettysburg and everyone gets slaughtered, right? Because this is the unseen hand. The purpose of the war is, you know, it's just to reduce population.
Yeah, the Battle of the Somme. Like, no one can see that coming.
And so, it's preposterous, but the symbols, you know, need to be understood, because then, you know, for example, Sherman's march to the sea makes sense. Then Jefferson's Davis's, exoneration at the end of the war by the Skull and Bone group, you know, the Freemason Skull and Bone group. I mean, this makes sense. You see what I mean? It's like the symbols aren't, I mean, people are aware, you know, it's kind of a hip thing to point out where modern celebrities flash the devil horns, you know, or make a, wear a Freemason's ring or something, you know. And like you point out, you don't really know how much of that is just copycat or people trying to be hip, or even like very low level Masons just trying to show off, you know.
Why is the Pentagon, which breaks ground September 11th, 1941, and they build it in the shape of a pentagram.
Right.
And they call it the Pentagon. Why not a square building?
Well, yeah, why not? I mean, isn't that odd? It's sort of like, why 666? I mean, what's going on here? You see, if you just get the symbolism as something needs to be decoded, it doesn't take you very long to understand the process of genocide. You see how important it is, Tim, why I'm glad we're talking about it? Because, you know, when you, just like with the Pentagon, you look at, well, gee, they broke ground on September 11th. That's interesting. And they decided to call it a pentagram. You know, well, this is very strange. I mean, I'll give you another like example.
What's weird is the Washington Monument fits perfectly in the middle. No, just joking. it used to. No, but anyway.
What an image! Oh God, that cracked me. You made me lose my place here. Now Helen Blavatsky, right? She has a mystic brooch. She's been given a Masonic, you know, diploma, which basically just gives her, you know, get out of jail card free among the Masonic big shots, from the Quattro Coronati, and they send her off to basically set up the Nazi party. And she creates the mystic brooch, right? Mm-hmm. Mystic brooch has two big images in it. It has the swastika, the same one that the Nazi party uses, and it has the Star of David. Now, remember, we talked about, well, gee, these symbols are weird because they're kind of jumbled. You have symbols that seem to relate to, you know, like Judaism, and then symbols that are uniquely Freemason, and somehow there's a, you know, way that they can coordinate. The symbols are basically should lead people to a question mark. You know, what is in back of the symbolism that they're presenting us? It's really, it's an important thing. And I want to commend Dyer on going through a lot of the show business stuff. People should attend his site and check that stuff out, because I think I don't agree with a lot of the stuff he comes up with, but I just think that the process, you know, is really important to get started. Because, you know, they really shouldn't get away with this crap. This really, the, you know, when you look at, like, you know, Walt Disney with Club 33, there's a symbol, right? Mm-hmm. When you look at the conclusion of Fantasia and you go, well, I don't know, you know, you start to, you know, get an image of something really nefarious. And then, of course, when you suddenly uncover the fact that the CIA funded the whole thing there in Florida, it's like, wait a second.
Why is the CIA opening,
right,
facilitating the creation of supposedly an amusement park?
Yeah, I mean, you see, this is the thing, Tim. People,
which is all, it's all DARPA related too, by the way. It's all
that
technology used for surveillance and control, things like that. Yeah,
but I mean, it's actually kind of an amazing contraption, because you have all of these people walking around mind numbed in Disney World, which is the most mind numbing area ever created in the history of mankind. I mean, if this thing is just, it just does nothing but process brain dead humans. You know, I mean, you ever been there?
Yeah, I've been there a couple of times.
It's just, I was there, took my kids there, and I mean, I just, to look at the people like staggering around trying to buy a cotton candy for $15, waiting in 5 hours to go off some kind of a cliff. I mean, it's just a ridiculous experience, you know. But they walk around having their senses dulled in an entity, you know, Disney World of fantasy, Eros, you know, that is there to process them to the genocide. And if they could just wake up to the symbols, right, which are all through the park,
yes,
right, then they would see, wait a second, I may be really fun spinning around in the, you know, magic teacup, but it looks like they're dumping me into a furnace here at the end. I mean, what kind of a ride is this? So, you know, I mean, try again. This goes to courage. We need to have this dialogue open up for everybody. We need to have this be the typical morning breakfast conversation between all couples.
And looking at something like Disney, which I think Disney is sort of an expression of MK Ultra, well developed. Because it's there. I mean, obviously, you said it's there to beguile and amuse and confuse and these things. This is culture creation. This is psychological warfare, and you can see that. I think more conspicuously, just in, not just the amusement park, but the sort of the entertainment fair that Disney produces, particularly children's programming. And yes, how they rope absolutely. You in, and so many of the Disney stars that are processed become these celebrities. They're manufactured, and you know, whether it's Britney Spears or Christina Aguilera or whatever, who's the other one? Who, you know, the actress
Justin Timberlake,
and the other these names I start to forget them. They all have these mental breakdowns, particularly the women.
Yeah,
once they become older, in their 20s or something, there's some breakdown in these things. But we all see that, you know, the Disney processes where they produce a character which is superficially wholesome. I think it's really, if you just spend time thinking about it, the whole thing is kind of satanic.
100% satanic. Absolutely.
But they don't. They become, you know, with the moment they hit the age, 18, they become the Whore of Babylon. You know, and this is after
Miley Cyrus as the best known of this phenomenon. But basically, she was just the worst case. There were dozens of other ones. You know? And of course, it's a process. It doesn't happen, circumstantially, time and time again. This is something that's being deliberately done to these poor kids. They sell their soul.
Mm-hmm.
They don't even know it, but Disney knows it. And so, again, it's the symbolism. And Miley Cyrus is one of the very worst. I wonder, someone like Cyrus, I wonder if she's not like from a Masonic family and was just somehow bred for the thing.
Her father comes from a banking family, so.
Yeah, that whole thing with Cyrus is a little weird. And then he ends up for some reason as a country singer.
He was a baseball player, and
he's just one of the very worst singers you've ever heard. You wonder why would someone?
What's weird is they're setting him up. They're setting him up so they can roll her out.
That's right. Well, and it was, but And okay, and then just work through the symbolism there. I mean, with Hannah Montana, her name, you know, is like forward and backwards, right? Mm-hmm. Hannah Montana, she has an alter ego, which then becomes her real life, right? She is a rock and roll star, but she has to pretend she's just a regular kid, and you know, but in fact, she has a secret world of being a rock and roll star. So all of this. This is mind control for all of the young children who are watching the thing. And then when she transitions to the Horror of Babylon, I mean, she just brings 100% of them ratcheted down a bit in terms of the culture that they're capable of living in, right? It just makes them debased. And so,
A while back we did a thing on the, when they had that alleged attack at the Ariana Grande concert. And just the idea, you know, you just examine the lyrics of her songs and just the image she projects and the age of the kids going to the concerts. And just when I was a young man, when I was a teenager, or preteen, we didn't go to concerts. That was something you did when you were a later teenager, maybe at post-16 perhaps. And you buy the ticket cost $8 or something. You went to go see a concert. I just started noticing that they started marketing these things to younger and younger kids, you know, with these Pop-Tart stars. And it just becomes more insidious and criminal as the age group gets lower and lower, because they don't have the discerning or any judgment. Not to say that teenagers have judgment either, but I'm saying it's a little less sleazy, I think, when you're marketing to a post-adolescent as opposed to a kid in the
Ariana Grande thing. They had a lot of families that they interviewed, and I wondered if that was just deliberate mind control.
Because
they just had so many of them, and I mean, of course, Ariana Grande is just an absolute cesspool that children should never be exposed to, and they would have like parents going, "Gee, we'd been like looking forward to the Ariana Grande. It was going to be like our family outing." I mean, just incredible, that you go, "Well, have you been arrested for child abuse recently?" I wondered if that was like artificial, if that had been, set up to basically normalize, like taking like 10 and 8-year olds to sexually debased concerts. Yeah. I mean, good grief.
And I'm sure the choreography, if you ever watched, calling these concerts is a stretch because there's very little singing and very little music at these places. It's just pyrotechnics and choreography and these things. And if you look, it's all modern dance, and it's all very, if you look at it, it's all very, well, it's all very sexual and also satanic. And so they're taking in this entire show. That's the important, again, this is the importance of ritual.
Good point. That's exactly what's going on. This is how they're doing it to us, And, it's funny, I had to laugh when you were saying, you didn't go to concerts, I didn't either. My family was basically kind of traditional Catholic, and my uncle was Robert Atwell, who was a Monsignor in Los Angeles Parish, and was very well known. Tim, he almost became bishop, or at least he claimed he did. He was quite a political, kind of priest and wanted to go up the ladder, but he stayed as a Monsignor. I remember his response when my sisters wanted to go to the Beatle concert. They were going to be in San Francisco, I think, and somehow we were going to be able to, they could get up there for some, they wanted to go.
Was this their final live concert, 66?
Yeah, I think it was, yeah. I mean, I wasn't really into the Beatles, but I'm just trying to...
Candlestick Park?
I think it was Candlestick Park, and they had evidently the opportunity, and Robert Atwell, my father, William, William Atwell, Father William, he came and he said, "Well, go, but you will be excommunicated." and I mean, he said, "I will personally see to it." And it's really interesting, because
of he saw William, something, so, didn't he? Yeah.
He was very prescient. It's funny when you think about it. And I thought he was nuts. I thought,
it's a harmless concert. Come on.
Just a kid. But I thought, you know, they have such cute hair and whatnot, you know, why would, you know, but he was adamant. He just said, no, it's a mortal sin. You know, that's, you know, he actually recognized Elvis Presley same way, you know, and so this is really funny. It shows you how successful they've been in shifting culture into debasement so slowly. You never know what's going on. And, you know, harping back to, you know, the symbols, I mean, you've got to pay attention, because this is one of the only ways, you know, that we can show the existence of the system of debasement. You know,
yeah, I mean, you probably remember this, but because you're a little older than I am, remind you of that. The Catholic Church, the parish, used to say to the parishioners to pledge not to see any obscene movies.
Absolutely.
And I remember I grew up, they weren't doing that anymore when I was in Catholic school in the 70s. But this was something in the 50s, and, you know, 30s, I guess 30s through until the mid 60s. But this, again, people see it as we kind of, well, that's kind of strict, don't you think? Well, when you're dealing with, you're dealing with the degenerates and the Satanists to run Hollywood.
I mean, how are you going to,
how else do you
deal them away? I would go, you know, with understanding that there was this deliberate attack upon, you know, Gentile culture, and that it isn't even just for the purpose of money. It's you know, basically genocide is coming forward. I would say in hindsight, I would have none of these things should ever be permitted to be seen by kids. You know, I mean, I would have just sequestered every 100% of show business. I mean, and then you know, that we had, like, I don't know, perhaps you can remember, we had a thing called the Legion of Decency. Mm-hmm. Remember that? Maybe you don't remember, but it was.
I know of it. Don't remember it.
Okay, well, yeah. It was a big deal. It had the capacity to rate films, and the Legion of Decency, if they said, well, if a film, this is like breaching kind of Christian protocol, you know, whatever, you know, we're going to give it a bad rating. They were in control basically of this rating system. And so you can, you know, in hindsight, you know, at that time they were seen as square and representing, you know, backwards ideas. Good heavens, in hindsight, I mean, they were absolutely right, you know. Every single idea that they had, every single thing. You know, I'm not someone who is, you know, I kind of lost my capacity to, like, have the religion as a matter of faith. But God, culturally, it just, I mean, my God, it made so much sense, you know, to sequester the parts of our world that were, you know, destructive. And, you know, it's funny, they had as the idea then that, you know, there was this sin component, right? That was how they sold it to me, you know, I mean, that's how I got to, it was said it was a sin. And that was, in hindsight, this was the wrong approach, because then when I kind of fell away, just, you know, as everyone in my age group did, I kind of fell away from religion just in general. Then the idea was, well, it's not sin, so it's okay to do.
Yeah, I see what you're talking about.
The shame they didn't pitch it as, this is cultural debasement by a group that wants to take you into oblivion. And this is going to destroy your capacity to have family. It's going to isolate you. It's going to make you politically impotent, you know. And basically, and it's going to end up with everyone you know, with no children and debt. Is that really what you want? Because that is what this thing is. That's what this modern, you know, culture movement, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, that's really what it is. I wish someone had been aware of it at the time. It's kind of funny in hindsight that no one was. I guess some people were, but they didn't really have a platform to articulate it, to get it through to people.
Well, unfortunately, they didn't have the sociological data to show just how destructive this behavior is. You had some speculator just rely on received wisdom, right? Well, unfortunately, now we have so much sociological data to show just how destructive this behavior is. that there is a congruence between the idea of sin, morality, and practical reason, which is what morality is, shorn of its religious, you know, trappings. But basically, there's it's destructive, unhealthy behavior, and things that are unnatural. They're unhealthy because they're unnatural, which is natural law, of course. But right. I mean, you can laugh at the Legions of Decency and, you know, some of its strictures, and it seems very prudish for us by today's standards. Idea, you know, only one, if there's a scene on the bed, one foot has to be on the bed, and these things. Wow, that's you know, based on our what we expect today, that's real strict. But if you look at what passes for entertainment today, it vindicates them. I mean, there's an example of there's a show called. I think it's Mr. Robot. It's a trans, humanist sci-fi that runs on one of the cable channels, like USA Network or something, which means the show runs during the day. And now most families have cable anyway. So, but there's a scene in it where one man is sodomizing another man, and it's, you can see it. And this is just a scene in the movie. In the TV show. And so this is how far we've come. And this is a show that will run, I don't know, 12 o'clock in the middle of the day on one of these networks.
Yeah, you know, you're so right. Thanks for bringing that up. You know, the thing is that because...
Good connection. We're just getting cut off a lot. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. Okay, well, I was just going to say that in hindsight, they were so right to try to draw the line where they did, because you can see that these were gatekeeping activities, right? That they were going somewhere, they were going to lead us off to a bad place, and that obviously the people who were creating this, this system knew about it. They weren't unaware. I mean, obviously, look at MK Ultra and, you know, and how desperately they were trying to get to the bottom of social control. They knew full well what Disneyland was about. We've been attacked, Tim. It's really clear. You know, when you look at, when you combine MK Ultra, the symbolism we've been showing, and and the kind of the awareness of cultural debasement that these guys had to pull to bring these things about, it's been an attack. You know, that's what we've been suffering with.
Well, and it's blatantly. I mean, it's blatantly pornographic, because you do not. You can have an adult, adult topic. You can have a movie about infidelity. You can have a movie about, you know, the drama behind it, the problem it creates, the pain it creates, or a movie about even about prostitutes and organized crime, these things, without having the sex. I remember The Godfather, which arguably, you know, you could say is a perfect film, but for some reason or other, he felt compelled to show a topless woman in it. You know, which is completely unnecessary. Yeah. Why do that? A lot of that is, you know, you can say because, you know, they're competing with TV, and TV, they couldn't show breasts, so they can show breasts in movies, they can speak in the theaters. But I don't think people went to The Godfather for the nudie scenes.
That's absurd, of course. It's absurd.
Obviously, they're debasing you for that. You know, it's there's ways you can handle some of these topics, and you can develop the art and be more sophisticated, not be sort of as... hokey as maybe some of those early movies were, acting and movie filmmaking could have developed without being scandalous and being debasing. I mean, there's some great movies that are great, that aren't debasing, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird, you know, even Terms of Endearment, which is a more modern, which, you know, that was a, you know, or, what's the other one? That movie with Robert Duvall in the early 80s, he plays that country singer, you watch that movie, it's completely clean, and it's a great drama.
It's hard even to imagine at this point such a thing, you know? I mean, I was like, geez, did such things ever exist on this planet? You know, yeah, but of course they did. And of course these things are possible. But, you know, we're not going to get that kind of entertainment fair, not out of this group that controls Hollywood, you know? They're in the business of destruction.
Yeah. I mean, what we're saying is that, of course, there's nothing inherently evil about filmmaking, but there's inherent danger to it, because the theater, the cinema has always posed a threat, not because of it, because it can be, like anything, it's weaponized, and it is weaponized because it's run by degenerate Satanist or Satan.
Yeah, you know, so. That's right. I mean, it's like, it's almost like where you can't even say it's weaponized. It's just who they are. Yeah. You know, they are just degenerate Satanists. And so when you look at their cultural product, it is going to be debasing and satanic. And you know what? I think they would actually almost admit this, because see, they, to them, it's a, well, of course, you know, they would just say, well, of course we debase culture. It's our right. You know, there's nothing wrong with that.
Wasn't that what the authoritarian personality is all about, though?
Exactly. I mean, just look at the authoritarian personality. If you want to see what, how they have the kind of the moral authority they have to create erotic propaganda for the purpose of shattering ethnicity. I mean, anyone who hasn't read the chapter 23 of, you know, the authoritarian personality, it's really kind of a, you know, in a place where they can't really understand the modern world very well, because they lay it out there for us, you know.
Oh, and, of course, yeah, sort of eroticism separated from anything to do with procreation. We get that in Brave New World too. Where,
yeah, you know, absolutely, we do, and so it's you know, so these are you know, trying times, and hopefully. One way we can get people to start recognizing the existence of the society, the plan of the society, and the elements that the society produces to damage us. I mean, this is why I think, you know, talking about symbolism is a good idea, because it just makes our world clear, you know, when you can actually look at these things and recognize that there is this system of symbolism. We haven't certainly exhausted it, you know, tonight, but it is there, and you know, people need to pay attention to it, because it'll help them understand the world.
Yeah. So, okay, Joe, let you go.
Jim. It's just great to spend time with you again. I'm looking forward to next week already.
Great. Enjoy your weekend.
You too, buddy.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Bye.